Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Jennifer Lowenstein, former Assistant Director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Wisconsin, who examines the current status of Gaza ceasefire talks and the looming threat of a wider regional Middle East war. Matt Brunig, president of the People's Policy Project, who assesses Democratic Party presidential candidate Kamala Harris's recently announced economic policy proposals. And Dr. Michaela Martinez of the group We Act for Environmental Justice, who talks about the dangers of toxic hair products marketed to women of color that are linked to cancer and other health dangers. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Vietnam's Mekong River Delta has historically provided perfect conditions for rice production. The region, home to 20 million people, is often called Vietnam's rice basket. But climate change, sand mining, and upstream dams blocking essential fertile sediments have all contributed to a decline in agricultural productivity in recent years. According to the Yale Environment 360 magazine, land in the delta is sinking as climate change is triggering rising sea levels, causing salt water to inundate the land, a growing risk to freshwater-dependent rice farming. The deteriorating conditions have rallied farmers, the Vietnamese government, international aid agencies, and development banks to take action to save the Mekong Delta. After the government understood that its intensified rice-growing policies were harming the environment and the economy, it embraced nature-based solutions, promoting an agricultural diversification policy to transition away from rice monoculture and toward aquaculture, growing fruits, vegetables, and ornamental plants. Win Hu Tien, a natural resources expert, said, "Before, we were so eager to conquer nature, but now at least we're starting to respect natural law." Across the state of Kansas, times are tough for local businesses. As farmers in the Great Plains states are hard hit by slumping commodity crop prices, shrinking government price supports, and high interest rates, the economic pain is spreading from the fields to Main Street. Reuters reports U.S. farmers are now confronting the worst economic conditions in a decade. The situation in America's prairie states is particularly severe, where small cities are at risk of becoming ghost towns. Farmers have endured 2 years of severe drought, followed by inflation of seed prices and rising chemical fertilizer costs, leading many Kansas small business owners to see a 25% drop in revenues. While the broader U.S. economy is growing strong, researchers reported that the nation's rural economy in the Midwest and Great Plains states has fallen as farm equipment sales and agricultural land prices dropped for the first time in 5 years. Along the U.S. West Coast, demand is growing for the export of wood pellets to Europe and other markets on an industrial scale. Wood pellets made of compressed wood are used as fuel for power generation and home heating. By grinding down trees into pellets, this growing biomass industry seeks to benefit from subsidies offered in Europe and Asia to encourage the growth of renewable energy sources. But in these times, magazine reports eco-activists are mobilizing in Washington state in opposition to the construction of a plant capable of producing 450,000 metric tons of pellets annually. Activists question the climate benefits of wood pellets that are often burned or co-fired with coal, supposedly reducing coal's emissions. But as one activist said, the most counterintuitive part is none of the associated carbon emissions are counted by governments who classify biomass as clean energy. As the wood pellet industry seeks to expand in the Pacific Northwest, the American South, and New England, there's a growing national movement to make climate policies more accurately reflect the carbon footprint of wood biomass, both in the U.S. and abroad. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As thousands of pro-Palestinian protesters marched outside the Democratic Party Chicago convention, demanding the U.S. end support for Israel's mass killing of Palestinian civilians in Gaza, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was engaged in a new round of ceasefire talks in the Middle East. Secretary Blinken announced on August 19th that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had agreed to an American so-called bridging proposal for a Gaza ceasefire deal. But representatives of Hamas responded by declaring that any ceasefire agreement must result in a permanent end to Israel's Gaza war, accusing the U.S. of merely buying time for Israel to continue its genocide. Hamas urged the world to pressure Prime Minister Netanyahu to sign the original deal proposed by President Joe Biden on May 31st that was supported by the United Nations Security Council on June 11th. Your reporter spoke with Jennifer Lowenstein, former Assistant Director of Middle Eastern Studies and Senior Lecturer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Here she examines the current status of Gaza ceasefire talks and the looming threat of a wider regional Middle East war after Israel's assassination of Hamas and Hezbollah leaders provoked angry calls for retaliation.
These negotiations are all a cover for Israel to continue doing exactly what it wants. It's also a process. The process here is more important than the actual talks to delay any kind of retaliation on the part of Iran and Hezbollah, both of which said they would not do anything until these ceasefire negotiations had ended and hopefully brought something good. But the ceasefire negotiations are not going to end in a ceasefire agreement, and that is because Netanyahu doesn't want a ceasefire. He's stated as much very plainly over the last 10 months and certainly in the last 2 months. So what happened is that the proposal that the United States claimed Israel wrote, which Israel rejected, was accepted by Hamas to Netanyahu's great despair. And as a result, Netanyahu added more conditions, and Hamas, of course, opposed those conditions. And this is where we are now. Now, Blinken is in Israel now, or at least on his way to Egypt, and he basically says that they've got a bridging proposal that Netanyahu accepted. But if we look at what the proposal is now, the conditions that are in it are conditions that Hamas would never and should never accept. It doesn't include a permanent ceasefire. It doesn't include a comprehensive withdrawal from the Gaza Strip. It allows Israel to retain control of the Philadelphia Corridor. It allows Israel to retain control of the Netzarim Junction, which will control the flow of people from the north to the south of Gaza and vice versa. It would deport a number of Palestinian prisoners released in the exchange deal outside of Palestine. Humanitarian relief would be made conditional on the approval of all these terms by Hamas. And the negotiations on the reconstruction of the Gaza Strip and lifting the siege will be left to the results of the discussions that will follow implementation of the first phase. None of these clauses or additions are acceptable to Hamas. There should be a permanent ceasefire and a permanent withdrawal from Gaza by Israel, and it should relinquish control of the Philadelphia Corridor, and it should get the heck out of Netzarim.
And Jennifer, I did want to ask you about this. What, if any, links are there in the current Gaza ceasefire negotiations with the prospect of retaliatory strikes from Iran and Hezbollah? Is there any kind of implicit promise that if a ceasefire is declared in Gaza and the slaughter of Palestinian civilians is stopped, that Iran and Hezbollah will take their threat of retaliation off the table?
It's very unlikely. And once again, we have to give this gold star to Netanyahu, because in this respect, he has managed to cause the Gaza war to transcend the fact that Iraq, Syria, Iran, Yemen, Hezbollah in Lebanon, that these powers were only attacking Israel or responding to Israel because of a solidarity front with the Gazans. But by assassinating Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran and Fuad Shukr in Beirut, both Hezbollah and Iran have promised retaliation. Now, what Iran has said was that a ceasefire would delay its response, not stop it, delay it. Until when, none of us know. Hezbollah, on the other hand, is already getting quite impatient. I believe we'll probably see a strike by Hezbollah before Iran. And that is because, besides being impatient, they just released a significant amount of video from an underground mountain city in which they have some of very Mod 4 missiles. And along with that video was the message that this is only the tip of what we have. We have stuff that's much, much stronger than this. The message to Israel was essentially, if you retaliate against our strike, this is what you're looking at. And going back to your question, it's very unlikely that either one of them will not retaliate owing to these two assassinations, regardless of whether there's a ceasefire or not.
That was Jennifer Lowenstein, former Assistant Director of Middle Eastern Studies and Senior Lecturer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who's currently active with the group Jewish Voice for Peace. Find more analysis and commentary on Gaza ceasefire talks and the threat of a wider Middle East war by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Not long before Democrats gathered in Chicago for their convention to formally nominate Vice President Kamala Harris as the party's presidential candidate, the presumptive nominee traveled to the battleground state of North Carolina to announce the broad outlines of her economic policy agenda. There she staked out positions on an issue that most Americans say is their top priority, and one that earlier polls found favored former President Donald Trump over the Biden administration. However, more recent polling has found Harris either catching up or surpassing Trump on who Americans trust more to manage the economy. The vice president prefaced her remarks by telling the audience that together we will build an opportunity economy, and declared that building up the middle class will be a defining goal of her presidency. Among the policies outlined was the goal of eliminating medical debt for millions of Americans, the first ever ban on price gouging for groceries and food, a cap on prescription drug costs, a $25,000 subsidy for first-time home buyers, and a child tax credit that would provide $6,000 per child to families for the first year of a baby's life. Your reporter spoke with Matt Brunig, president of the People's Policy Project, a left-wing think tank. Here he assesses some of Vice President Harris's economic policy proposals while suggesting alternative progressive programs and strategies.
You know, I think Harris does not have strong policy views herself. You know what I mean? She's not like a politician like Bernie Sanders, let's say, who he's got a very strong opinion about what he thinks the policy should be and what America should look like. I'd say Kamala is a more traditional, conventional politician who is interested in holding office, interested in winning elections for herself and maybe broadly for the Democratic Party. And from there, kind of is willing to do whatever, right? So we can kind of see this pretty clearly from looking at Kamala Harris from 2020 to Harris at present. In 2020, if you remember, she endorsed the idea of putting everyone on Medicare, or a Medicare Advantage type system. And now her health care plan is to increase subsidies for people who buy insurance on the Obamacare exchanges. She's distancing as much as she can from the Medicare for All stuff that she sort of played around with, which I think just is an indicator that she's kind of, you know, she just doesn't have strong commitments, and she'll kind of go where she thinks, you know, the energy is. And so for now, I think the way she's approached this is, let's try to run on stuff that seems pretty small, pretty moderate, that doesn't expose you to a lot of risk and attack and stuff like that, because ambitious programs often, you know, do attract negative attention.
Well, Matt, another policy proposal from Kamala Harris that's quite popular is the proposal for a $6,000 tax credit for newborns, as well as a $3,000 child tax credit, which were, of course, boosted during COVID.
This is a common benefit in other parts of the world. It's usually called a maternity grant, or it's called a baby bonus. Finland famously gives all new parents this box of baby items called a baby box, and that's kind of their version of it. At People's Policy Project, I'd previously proposed that, like a baby box for all new parents, but cash works as well. You can buy a crib with cash. You don't need the government to send you one. And so as a general idea, sure, I don't know, 6,000, 5,000, 4,000, you know, who knows what the appropriate amount is. But it seems like the structure she has in mind is, for the first year of life, your child tax credit will be 6,000 instead of being what it is now, 2,000 or 3,000 that she's proposing for the other years of life. I think that's basically a good idea. First year of life, there are a lot of costs, cribs, clothing, strollers. People are out of work taking care of their infants, giving them a little extra money, I think makes sense. Now, I do have issues with doing it as a tax credit. This is a problem that I've been pointing out for literally a decade, which is that these tax credits don't reach low-income households, and they're not timed appropriately. So think about it. If you have a kid in February of 2025 and you want to get this $6,000 credit, well, you can only get the credit when you file your taxes. Well, you don't file taxes until the early part of next year. So you've gone the whole 11 months of the kid's first year of life without getting the $6,000. So I don't think tax credits are a good way to do that because of that timing delay, and that it would be much better to just have the Social Security Administration give you the $6,000. Whenever you have a kid, the first thing you do in the hospital is you enroll them in Social Security. You put them on the list. They get a Social Security number. There's no reason why you couldn't also say, all right, as soon as you enroll your kid in Social Security, they'll send you a check for $6,000. Very clean, easy way to implement it, whereas the tax credit is much messier. And a lot of low-income people don't file taxes at all.
Well, Matt, obviously these economic proposals from Kamala Harris are about winning votes in the November election. From your point of view, both in terms of sound policy and what's most important for the lion's share of Americans, which of these policies do you think are most important to fine-tune and really make it specific so that if she does win the election, she can hit the ground running and take action on it?
To me, I think right now where the U.S. is, the most important thing is really to build up social benefits. We really lag the rest of the world in things like paid leave, childcare benefits, cash benefits for kids. Our healthcare system is a disaster. So that's where I tend to focus. So in that sense, these tax credits for newborns, the baby bonus, and then the child tax credit, and then even the increase in subsidies for Obamacare exchange plans, that's all good. That's all like moving in the right direction. It's very easy. It's very tangible. Like I said, I would do it differently. But the basic idea and that focus, I think, is very good. Messing around with subsidies for buying homes, I think, is a little bit harder to understand. And then these very vague kind of, we're going to take on the grocery stores, I'm not going to tell you how, I think is probably the least meaningful. With that said, there's a kind of a question of what happens when she's president, right? So if she's president, but they don't have Democratic majorities in Congress, then she's going to be very limited to what she can do with executive agencies. Practically, it really depends on how Congress goes and all that. But if in my ideal world, I'm playing fantasy politics, I'm focusing more on the things that improve our social benefit system over the rest of the proposals.
That was Matt Brunig, president of the People's Policy Project, a a left-wing think tank. Find a link to his recent Jacobin magazine article titled "Our Verdict on Kamala Harris's New Plans" and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The dangers of toxic hair straightening or hair relaxing products made for African American women was recently investigated in a New York Times Magazine article. Some of these products have been linked to reproductive disorders, cancers, and other health issues. Whether or not to use these products is just one of the decisions Black women make that can come with negative health consequences as they try to fit in the mold of European beauty standards. Michaela Martinez is Director of Environmental Health with the group We Act for Environmental Justice. Her organization collaborates with city and state health departments to test a wide range of products for toxicity and shares their data about health impacts. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Martinez, who says such products have disproportionate impacts on people of color, but that the issue affects everyone who uses any personal care products. She warns that the industry standard is to use toxic chemicals and fossil fuel-derived substances.
When it comes to toxic chemicals in beauty products, what we see is that some of the most notoriously toxic products are those that are created for and marketed to women of color. So the hair straighteners are one really good example that have been getting a lot of attention recently because of the formaldehyde in hair straighteners being linked to hormone-sensitive cancers such as uterine cancer. One of the other notoriously toxic beauty products that we work on are skin lighteners. And so skin lighteners are a multi-billion dollar industry worldwide, and they're only becoming more popular instead of less popular. And skin lighteners are used for many things, including like lightening your skin very generally, but also they will be marketed as, you know, making you look younger or brighter, more dewy. There are also skin lightening products that are used for more targeted area, such as like freckles or dark spots, underarms, elbows, knees, etc. But the really dangerous thing about skin lighteners is many of them contain mercury. And that's because mercury, even though it is completely illegal in much of the world to put mercury in cosmetics, because mercury is a very dangerous neurotoxin, companies continue to do this illegally and off-label because mercury is an incredibly effective skin lightener because it blocks melanin production in the skin. So products with mercury are highly effective, and we see mercury poisoning cases in the United States along with lots of other health issues associated with skin lighteners because they oftentimes also contain like corticosteroids and another chemical called hydroquinone. And so together these things, mercury, hydroquinone, corticosteroids can effectively lighten the skin, but at a very, very high physical cost in terms of, you know, these adverse reactions and, you know, in some cases, like literally brain damage and such. Then, of course, there's the kind of societal impacts and then your impacts on well-being and mental health that come with just the existence of skin lighteners. But generally, they're based in white supremacy, colonialism, colorism, and classism, and some combination of these things, and also in some places patriarchy as well, because there'll be like first instance in India, a lot of the marketing also has to do with kind of bridal marketing as well, like whether a woman would be able to find a husband depends on your skin color, etc., etc. So there are some of the most kind of toxic, like psychologically toxic notions in society are really kind of wrapped into the existence of marketing of skin lighteners. It also depends whether you're looking at the consumer or also occupational health. Because when we look at hair salons and also nail salons and the use of things like hair relaxers, then women, oftentimes it's women and women of color that are working in hair salons that are utilizing hair relaxers and hair dyes and other products regularly that tend to be of high toxicity. So there's all of that occupational exposure. And then another kind of salon area where there's really high occupational exposure is nail salons, because you'll have formaldehyde and a whole slew of endocrine disruptors and toxic chemicals that are routinely used in nail polishes, things, acrylics, you know, you name it.
It seems like the other aspect besides trying to actually make these things safer, like remove toxic elements, is like a cultural piece that, you know, so that women of color don't feel like this is the beauty norm that they want to achieve. Does the Beauty Inside Out, is that any part of your work?
Yeah, that's a huge part of our work. So that's what we spend a lot of time doing in our educational discussions. Like, we talk about colorism. We talk about these products being based in white supremacy. We also have, like, hard conversations about the ways that within our own communities, we might reinforce some of these negative, these harmful concepts, I would say. So, like, for instance, when I do trainings about the hazards of skin lighteners, and I talk about colorism, which, so colorism, we need to distinguish that separately from racism. So colorism is within a racial or ethnic group when you have discrimination based on skin color, you know, that's favoring lighter skin color and being discriminatory against people with darker skin. And so when we have conversations like, okay, when you're talking to family members, avoiding things that have this undertone to them, like don't stay outside too long, or, you know, you might get too dark, or, you know, make sure to cover up.
That was Michaela Martinez, Director of Environmental Health with We Act for Environmental Justice. Learn more about her group, The Health Dangers of Hair Straightening Products, and Safe Personal Care Alternatives by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRWK in Midlothian, Virginia, WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, KODX in Seattle, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.